What's up, everyone? Thanks for tuning in Asian Bitches Down Under, a podcast about sharing information and perspectives from the Asian diasporas in society and culture. We encourage you to subscribe to our show via Apple, Google, or Spotify. If you have enjoyed our episodes, please support us by giving us a 5-star rating and get your friends on board to listen to us. Finally, we would love you to support this podcast by donating to our Buy Me a Coffee program. Your wonderful support and donations will help us to continue creating the platform for diversity and inclusivity. Make sure you check out the episode show notes for any collaborations we're working with to promote. Thanks again, and we hope you will enjoy today's episode.
Hey y'all, this is Jessie.
Hi, this is Helen.
And we are Asian Bitches Down Under. Helen, have you heard of Asian American Writers Workshop?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
But I'm not very familiar with it. Yeah, tell us about it.
Okay, so they're an amazing non-for-profit organization. Mm-hmm. They're celebrating this year their 30th year of existence.
30 years already. Why don't we have that in Australia?
Jesus, you know, Christ, I think about that every day. Yeah, yeah, I think about that every day as a citizen of this country.
But it's a sweatshop, but it's not really targeting
to Asian people. Yeah. Yeah, that's probably one of the closer things. Uh-huh. Sweatshop, that's true. Operating off out of Western Sydney, obviously, with the ingenious Winnie Dunn doing a lot of great work there. But the Asian American Workshop, the reason why I want to mention that is because I actually spent this morning, Friday morning, early morning, doing a workshop with a poet called Trung Duc Tran. And the workshop I was surrounded, it was on Zoom, but I participated in a space with 12 other Asian women. They just happened to be women. But
nice.
It's really the workshop. The organization runs workshops and publishes books and events and runs events basically promoting and helping create a network of Asian American writers. Mm-hmm. And I was very fortunate enough to be invited into the space, not being American, but being Asian. And the workshop title was Writing from a Place of Politics, Race, Craft and Rage. And it was really, and I know I hate this word using it, but very powerful and empowering space to be 3 hours being around other Asian women and hearing their experiences of how they channel their anger into writing.
Yes.
And what the relationship they have with writing and anger.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it's something that I've been thinking about a lot recently. And I guess the writer and the poet who was running the workshop, Trung Duc Tran, he was kind of like saying how so much of our art comes from a place of being sidelined from the moment we were born, right?
Yeah.
And like trying to fight against the erasure and the absence that we're forced, and the silencing that often happens for marginalized people in a white Western world. And it was sensational. I think out of the 3 hours, one thing that I really liked what Trung said was that the idea of craft is a very Anglospheric white pedagogy. You know, when we talk about craft, when we talk about people going to do MFAs, when we talk about academia, the whole space of academia in Western society is very white. Like everything is constructed through a white lens. And so, like, I really liked what he's saying from the get-go. He was like, I don't want to talk about craft. This idea of craft in writing is very white-centric, and I'm not interested in trying to make you guys write like a white person.
Dominated by the lens through, you know, white people because of the power dominance and the how the society is constructed in the Western nations.
Yeah, it's always, exactly.
Yeah, it's always been
through
like
the white lens. And I was so compelled, and I felt very enlivened and strengthened by the capacity of articulation that a lot of the young women I shared that space with on Zoom this morning had encompassed. And I just thought, wow, this is what it means to be white.
Oh, yeah.
What it means to be white just must feel like to be seen. Because I've grown up in a world where I feel like my whole life has been just a persistent push to try to be seen. And like the teacher, Trung, was like saying, try and not perform your otherness, because that's what they want. They want you to perform trauma. They want you to perform how they see you. And like there's a lot of strength in trying to refuse that performance of otherness, which is thrown on, which is like really injected into us the moment we were born into a white society, and we're not white, you know.
I think it's the difficulties that we need to overcome, and also it's a struggle for a lot of like people of color creators. I think that sometimes we want to create for the sake of being seen, but at the same time, we don't know how we can present it to become popular.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I see a lot of, I don't want to criticize Asian creators, but there are creators that are out there that are creating certain contents, let's say for now, like social media platforms, that are generally very close, they have close proximity to whiteness.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Do you know,
totally.
There's a certain elements that they have of how they present themselves that is seem very close to whiteness.
Yeah.
But whereas if you do something different, say like, I don't know, criticize whiteness and you get...
Yeah.
You know,
sidelined.
You get or sidelined.
You just don't... You get silenced, basically.
Yeah.
You get silenced.
As if you, like, you shouldn't be questioning the authority of whiteness.
Totally, totally. And like, it's a very... everyone comes to the floor with their own aesthetics, right?
Mm.
And I feel like it's like a constant battle for me trying to negotiate the absolute yearning to be seen while also the yearning to be seen and acknowledging that often when I am seen, I'm playing into these tropes made by white people, you know, but then like trying to push against that and then wanting to be completely myself, but then consequently being rejected the moment I say, hey, this is me. Hey, this is what I want to write. And then they can't understand what I'm trying to do. And then they can't, and then they refuse to see me.
Yeah.
You know? It's so complicated.
Yeah. It's so complicated and so hard for creators, you know, following what they really want to do and be seen because it's something new. It's very new for the overall society. I wouldn't say to accept, but to be seen. But at the same time, how are you going to navigate through that, the complicated intersectionality of, you want to be authentic to yourself, but at the same time, you want to be seen. But then there's also a bigger power of authority that, like, you know, gatekeepers, there's, you know, powers in every industry that try to stop you or try to stop you, you know, having presented onto, the, you know, the bigger world.
I know, it's just such a, like, I feel very, I'm coming into a space where I'm trying, where I am feeling more comfortable in embracing that contradiction and all those complexities. You know, I feel grateful that I get to spend my life trying to work out these really messy, gooey, chunky problems and like try and write them out onto the page, you know? Yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah. And I'm really glad to be even sharing this with you on this podcast. And this podcast is part of that extension of me trying to work out all those questions with you.
Yeah.
And all our listeners out there, you know?
Absolutely.
So from that complicated and very thick, very thick and intense start, Helen, how was your week?
From that very complicated situation to another very complicated situation.
Yeah.
I had the opportunity to go to see a theatre play last weekend, and thanks to Jess, who my child.
That was a lot of fun. My partner and I helped
babysit because she doesn't like being called baby. So like child said.
Child minding.
That's right. So it was the play that we went to see was called White Pearl. It was a production that was played at Sydney Theatre Company. And I don't know how to...
Helen, you have a lot of issues.
So much issues about this play.
I know. First of all, thumbs up or thumbs down? Thumbs down.
This is a complication of what we just discussed just then. You know, we don't want to criticize on Asian content creators.
Right, okay.
But at the same time, it just, when there's something that we don't feel like it's not really our genre, it's not really the type of production that we like. And I feel like this is like the kind of production that has a lot of issues for me. You know, personally, so this is very subjective. You know, I know that there are a lot of reviews out there that might say that, yeah, it's a great scene. We have an all Asian. Oh, the writer is Asian. The writer is Thai.
What about the reviewers?
The reviewers are white people, and also the director is white as well. So I think that might be, I don't know how that plays out, but I do think that whoever's directing a play, a movie, does have a lot of direction and power over how the production is presented through the lens of the director. This is kind of like my feeling and my conclusion about this play. Before that I get into it, I'm just going to set out, let the listeners know that what White Peril is about. So essentially, it's a story about, a fictional story. Sometimes I feel like it's not really fictional. Written in the setting of a Singaporean cosmetic company. They were dealing with it like a PR crisis because they approved, one of the staff approved an ad that was played in China that is considered very racist. Anyone who can remember, I think a couple of years ago, a Chinese company, a laundry detergent company, had a similar incident where they had an ad putting a black person into the washing machine
with
laundry detergent. And then once the cycle is finished, a white person jumps out. They thought it was funny, okay? Quite racist if you don't see the nuance around it. I don't know how that was approved, but apparently in China it was considered okay because we know that still a lot of Asians are very racist. I think this is what this play, White Pearl, is trying to get to.
Right.
However, there's a lot of shock factors, very explicit racism displayed by Asian characters because the whole crew, the characters are all Asian. You see that there's a Korean chemistry consultant, the boss is British Indian, there's another, I don't know what her position is, but she's a Singaporean Chinese, and there's a office manager who is with a Japanese background, and then I guess a PR personality who is a Thai American. So I don't really know whether or not the writer has something against all different Asians, like also it portrays that Asian are not the single group, but it really exemplify individual Asian characteristics. For example, I feel like the accents did really amplify to the point it sounds like it's mocking each Asians.
Yeah, right.
And there's a display of the obedient Japanese characters. I feel like I'm not speaking for all the Japanese diasporas out there, but I feel like it's like a display of this submissive, obedient Japanese girl in the office, you know, always bows, always been polite to their colleague. And they've always been polite to the others. And also there's a Chinese character that cries every time that she's upset. And it's like, I'm not saying that showing vulnerability is not a good thing, but it's got to the point that it was really repetitive.
When you came out of the theater, you told me that you wanted to like even walk out at one point because they just made that crying Chinese character so excessive in her crying that it got to the point of...
It was just unbearable. I mean, I'm speaking from a perspective of a mom who went through two kids. It was just so too much for me. And also the Singaporean character who's tried to inspire to present herself more of a westernized person and uses like American vernaculars in her speech, which later been teased by another character saying that, oh, you've never been outside of Singapore, you know, why do you put up that accent? And I just feel like the whole play I was watching was like about the Asian female characters belittling each other, you know, being racist towards each other, even though that they leaked out a viral racist ad and they're finger pointing each other. I just don't understand. I don't really think nowadays they will be anyone use N-word, even in Asian community, even at your workplace. In workplace scenarios, they just casually throw out this N-word and think, oh, no, it's nothing. You know, we use this word. It's almost like saying that it's because the audience are majority white.
Oh, yeah, it's STC. It's
almost like saying that, oh, this is what a lot of Asians do in their office in Asia, in Asian office. And there's a lot of repetitive dialogues and toxic aggressions between each every characters, and also there's also misogyny in this play. There was this French male character who uses his advantage to manipulate women as well, you know. There's this part that I honestly dislike. I know that it might be representing the reality, but I don't know why that the writer incorporated this scenario in the
what happened
in a play. So this French character, he's the one who leaked out the viral video, and they were trying to salvage how to, you know, save the reputation of the company. And apparently the Thai American woman's character is his ex.
Right.
And then she was saying that, oh, I found out that you're the one who leaked the video, so can we bargain to get you to take down that video? And even though that she's so rich, this is what I hate the most, is that during the bargaining, she said that, what about if I give you a blowjob? Can you take down the video? What I hate it is that it kind of perpetuates the idea that Asian woman uses sex as a trade-off. I even thought that the character in the play is so rich, she can just pay him off, you know? But they have to put a sex scene for her to... It's almost like, oh, I have to create this shock factor. An Asian woman gives a blowjob to a white dude. It creates like an amplify as a humongous shock factor throughout the whole play. And that's... I'm not saying that, you know, we don't have the liberty to represent ourselves as a sex symbol, but it's just perpetuates that kind of stereotypical submissiveness of Asian woman.
You know, she's Asian woman sexualized.
I know that it presents the reality of corporate world, especially for the cosmetic industry, you know, there's a lot of negative energy and there's no reconciliation whatsoever at this end of the play. Like, by the end of the play, it's really exhausting for me. If the play was played in an Asian country for an Asian audience, it might be a little bit more appropriate because the Asians can reflect themselves to the complexity about jokes and racism, you know, a lot of constrained ideas about beauty and whiteness. But I don't think it's appropriate for the white audience. It's almost like giving the white audiences a chance to laugh at how Asians stereotype, like the Asian stereotypical traits, and how Asians are racist as fuck, you know? And how Asians are aspire to the proximity of whiteness. So
this just sounds like the most awful thing, honestly.
It wasn't an enjoyable play for me. Even with my husband, he said that, I don't know, I just feel really uncomfortable sitting through the play. And I looked up some reviews and there was something that quite interesting. There's this white male reviewer.
I don't care what they think, but go on.
I don't care what they think, but I think he had a point when he was writing this. He said that I must take a moment, even though that I'm as a white male reviewer, I know that he needs to put his language, not to the point that he might sound racist, but I think he's got a point. He says that taking a moment to acknowledge that there is a very high chance that many of the cultural insights and many of the satires went over my head. However, it remains confronting to set through increasingly vile racist remarks that lead to minimal consequences. So there's no consequences at the end. The play ends with all the characters pointing at each other, making racist remarks to each other. You know, the usual racist remarks that you make towards individual Asians. So I don't know how that's supposed to be enlightenment or supposed to be experimental, but it was, very strange.
Well, that is, like, everything you've just said in the last 10 minutes just screams of problematic to me. And I think I have a lot of things to say. First of all, that I'm really disappointed that you had to sit through this because
they had an opportunity to do something good.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Helen, you see, like, I think the last time Helen went to see a play was, like, maybe 25 years ago. And so, like, it's so rare for Helen.
No, we went to
maybe 40 years ago.
No, fact.
Maybe a month ago. But I mean, like, it's so rare for Helen to go and see a great, like, theatre production. And it is great. It's SCC, you know. They have a lot of money backed. And so disappointing that this is like, it's like years since you've seen an STC play and this is the one you first see after years, and then it's like so, it's so problematic, and mm-hmm. it doesn't help, and it's so not conducive to making the world a better place. And mm-hmm. I have to say, everything you're saying just makes me think, like, I just keep thinking, the only Asians that, like, the people in the audience, these white people, they probably don't have one single Asian friend. And so they go and see this play and they're like, oh, this is what Asians are like. Mm. You know, it's like, it's so, I hate that this has happened. It makes me very, very angry that it's just another way for white supremacy to occur, you know, for white people to sit in the audience and be told this specific and belittling and dehumanizing narrative of Asian women.
Yeah.
You know, it's so sick. It makes me sick. It makes me sick.
Uh-huh. It's almost like they're putting a show with... They don't even have to have characters that are Asian to play out this kind of story.
Yeah, exactly.
It's almost like Yellowface.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
How this kind of story will happen in a white corporate office as well.
Yeah.
But because, you know, the writer is Thai Australian, it's probably... their experience when they were living in Singapore. I don't know, when writers say that it's fiction, I always will consider, oh, how fiction.
It's probably not.
You know, you're writing from your experience. So,
and like, what's so funny is that on the website for the play, under the tagline of the title, it says hilarious, incisive, and packed with razor sharp dialogue. I'm like. It's hilarious because, like,
I don't see the jokes just, there. Yeah, I honestly just, don't see anything.
It's such a white gaze.
It might be there might be a little bit of tiny humor throughout the whole play, but I don't think there's a lot of jokes around. I don't think it's right to laugh at racist remarks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think it's the shock factor.
That's the thing. That's the reason why. I mean, this whole production is such a demonstration of just how oblivious STC is to its own whiteness. Like, even the description it has, like, hilarious, incisive, impact with razor-sharp dialogue. Like, how unaware they must be to, like, use those descriptions to describe humour that is racist, you know, racist humour in that way. That just shows me how freaking oblivious they are to their own racism. Don't you think?
Yeah.
It's just,
I don't have anything against the actors, actress, you know, it's just the storyline. Yeah. It just feels not right. It didn't sit right with me. And I always, I almost felt like thinking when I finished the play, I immediately looked up of who directed this play.
Yeah.
And I found out it's a white woman.
Yeah.
And I do wonder whether or not they had a dramaturg. Where they, you know, explores and the culture nuances of individual scenes and individual aspects of how this play could reflect on who is watching. I don't really think that they probably did that. That's why it was really messy for me. It was so chaotic.
Are you saying that in the play, the N-word is actually used?
Oh, they used the word... with one G, the one with the double G, they were all almost gonna blurt it out. The character was almost gonna say it, but she acts like so innocently, saying that as if that word is like can throw around casually at the public place. But the other characters stopped her. As if it makes it look like that Korean character is.
Stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So and then like, white people can laugh at that because
why is that funny?
Yeah, because also white people can market this as hilarious because they have most people who go to STC are like, you know, eastern suburbs, old folks who went to private schools and who have never and will never understand the history of that word. Will never understand the weight of trauma for those people affected by, you know, everything that word is associated with. And that's why it makes me angry. It makes me so angry.
Yeah, so exhausting.
We should send this episode to STC.
So speechless. Like, I don't have anything against the actors, the players, the writers. But I do have a question, like, to the writer, is in, okay, what's the purpose of having this play? Like, why do you what's the intention of writing this play? Exactly. Because, like, in the past, we interview, you know, theatre players, and kind of review plays and movies, and we always ask ourselves, what's the intention? What's the purpose of this work?
What did you want to say?
Yeah, what do you want to say, and how does it affect the society overall?
Yeah, exactly.
Because you don't want to have something that's just unproductive, you know? You don't want to have something that's, you're not really bringing out positive energy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You're not making the world a better place by changing the dehumanizing stereotypes of people of color.
Yeah.
It feels as though this play just,
I mean, it's a storytelling, really, obviously, but there's nothing that's at the end of the work that you go home with something, as if, like, presented there. Yeah, I know that's a reality of the world, but are you trying to, how can you kind of make it a bit more rounder? How can you give a bit more positive energy out of it?
And provide nuance.
Exactly.
Really, like, simplistic stereotypes that have been thrust upon us. Yeah, I just think this play has been funded, produced, and backed by white people for white people, basically. So that's why Helen, people like you and me, I mean, you've seen it. I'm just looking at the show. It actually ends tomorrow, Saturday. And I was actually thinking about going to see it because of what you've said. But there's only two seats left tonight, okay, tonight's show, and like one tomorrow. So I think I'm going to have to miss it. But I also probably don't want to support such a problematic production and
it's just very strange because we all want to celebrate Asian work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it's just this conflicted feeling about how this work is presented just didn't sit right with me at all.
Wow, that was a really long contrast consumption. Really quickly, I want to say two things. Recommendations on Netflix: Anatomy of a Scandal.
Everyone's talking about it.
Yeah, I don't know the stuff I've heard. Mostly people bagging it out. I don't know why, because I think it's like one of the best things I've seen in so long. It's so good. I felt it was only 6 episodes. Just watch it, even just for Sienna Miller's style. I think Sienna Miller is probably, I know she's a white woman, but I just think Sienna Miller is probably the most iconic fashionista. Like, she just knows how to dress. I love her style. And the twist at the end is just excruciatingly, profoundly good. It's based on a book by Sarah Vaughan, and I can't wait to read it. So that's showing on Netflix. And the other thing I want to say was Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. We watched it last night. And it was
such a retro movie.
So comforting. Everything from the 80s and 90s is so comforting.
Yeah, it's one of the movies that plays almost like monthly at 8 p.m.
On Channel 10? Yeah. Right, yeah.
We were growing up.
Right, yeah. I don't remember that, but I think I must have seen it as a kid. And Rick Moranis is just, you know, classic Rick Moranis. Do you know the story of him? Like, Billy told me this the other day.
Okay, yeah.
So he actually was at the height of his fame and he had to take a step back and retire from acting because his wife had suddenly died from cancer, and he wanted to raise the kids.
Okay.
So that was the reason he stepped back from Hollywood, which I just find that's so, like, it's so beautiful. It's so heartening, you know? But, yeah, so those are my two recommendations this week, two great films. Book-wise, I think I'll circle back next week and talk about that. Okay, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the best movie Helen and I have seen. Yeah, there we go. And, of course, it is
Everything, Everywhere, All at Once.
Or also known as EEAAO. EAO. Yeah. Just for short.
This is kind of called EEAAO.
Yeah. Okay, we'll be right back.
Okay, Okay, so we're back, and today we're going to talk about the best movie ever, the epic and highly stimulated entertainment experience that we both had the past week.
Yeah, I love that, Helen. I love that the way you've said it, because I have to say, it really was not a film for me. It didn't feel like a film. Uh-huh. It was actually an experience.
Yes.
That's what it felt like. It was an experience. And it was such an emotional experience. And yes. I thought, I remember after we watched it, I turned to my partner and I said, that movie felt like the whole essence of what a movie should do. It should feel like a whole body, whole life, historical, just all-encompassing experience. And that's really what it felt like for me.
Mm-hmm. So the movie we're talking about today is Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Which starring Michelle Yeoh and coming back, Kwai Hui Kwan. Is that how I pronounce it?
Yeah, he's basically the little boy in Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
The little boy.
I think that's his character so now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that movie was in 1984, and we're talking about almost 40 years later, we're seeing it on super screen again. The reason why is that I think that he went to the production side rather than the acting side.
I thought we were going to talk about the movie.
Okay, let's talk about the movie first. You start.
Okay, yeah, and then we'll talk about him because his story is interesting. Yeah. So we're going to assume all of y'all have watched it, and I don't know one Asian who hasn't watched it. I literally have the moment I finished watching it, I messaged on all my platforms, all my Asian friends, and all of them had seen it, and all of them had amazing, beautiful things to say back to me. It was almost like another Turning Red moment, you know. And
yes.
You know, the moment we finished watching Turning Red, I extended my inquiries to all my Asian friends, and they all watched it, and they all had, opinions about it.
Everyone's talking about it.
And finally, we're like, oh, this is what it feels like to be white. You just feel seen. You just feel seen on the big screen, you know?
Yeah. So, speaking of Turning Red and also this movie, Everything Everywhere All at Once, I think we're just going to use the acronym. It's so hard to say the whole name. The name of the movie is so long. EEAAO, we loved it.
We'll just call it Everything.
Everything.
We'll
call it Everything. Let's call it Everything. So whereas Turning Red is a movie about Asian diaspora's childhood and coming of age experience, I think Everything is a movie about how the Asian diaspora's middle age crisis. Playing a homage to Asian, specifically Chinese immigrants' families.
Chinese.
But I don't think it should stop there. So where do you want to start?
Well, I guess there's so many places to start.
Mm.
But I just want to say, so many reasons I love this film, but one of the main reasons is because Michelle Yeoh's character, she looks just like Mum.
Oh, okay.
I think Mum's prettier, but I just think the way she dressed, everything was just I saw my mum on the big screen.
Okay, so which version? Of Evelyn did you think?
Oh, right, right.
The laundromat lady.
The laundromat lady. Yeah. That's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is just the moment we finished watching it, I went on my phone and kind of scrolled through the reviews. And I didn't read any of them, but I read the headlines, and all of them had some sort of ecstatic description of it, wild, amazing, this is whirlwind of a journey movie. A lot of the reviews called it wild, and a lot of them called it crazy. A lot of people called it crazy, trying to describe it. And I just thought, I haven't written a review of it. I don't know even how I could begin to process all of, but if I did, I think what I would focus on, Helen, is just purely for me, that movie was not wild. It was not psychologically mind-bending or anything. For me, it was just a beautiful love story between a mother and a daughter. That's all it was for me. That was really, at the end of the day, for me, that's what it was for me. A beautiful love story between a mother and a daughter.
Mm-hmm. I don't even know where to begin. I think I want to firstly talk about the visual and special effect. This is something that both of us don't really talk about because we're more concentrating on the plot. But I think it's very psychedelic. There's a lot of flashing in and out and extraordinary settings. The setting has kind of a vibe of the old Hong Kong movie styles, the Wong Kar-wai's poignant melancholy, like despondent kind of sentiment. That's how I feel sometimes in the movie. However, I don't know if we should go into the plot because it's just
too complicated.
It's very complicated because it's like a combination of a family drama movie combined with a sci-fi
superhero
type of genre. Yeah. To me, it feels almost like a very collective healing process for Asian diasporas about parenthood, intergenerational trauma,
migration,
the migration, the torment from moving from one country to another country, from your own family, especially as a woman, from the own family to establishing your own family and living in the system that you're not fully accept into. I feel like there's a lot of symbolic message that the writer or the director is trying to convey with the experience at the IRS, the tax office for us in Australia, is ATO.
Oh my gosh, yeah, ATO. And the villain in this movie is Jamie Lee Curtis,
who's just
brilliant. So brilliant in this movie as the baddie. And basically, like Helen said, it's people call it crazy because the movie goes through a lot of different possible realities.
Yes.
In one of the potential realities, Jamie Lee Curtis and Michelle Yao, who are in real life like enemies, they're actually lovers,
mm-hmm.
and it's like the sausage fingers.
Fingers, well. Yeah.
It's like so many people loved. Another thing I want to say that I loved was I loved the costumes in this, especially the costumes worn by the daughter
for Joy, Joy is played by Stephanie Hsu.
Yeah, who is just absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah,
absolutely
she's gorgeous.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I think my favorite scene is the scene where it's the scene where the Joy, the daughter, is like fighting a bunch of cops or security guards, and like every single second her character changes, like she's in a different costume.
Yeah,
it's so good. I love that scene. It was like ecstatic and amazing.
Yeah, I don't even know where to begin, like describing Stephanie Hsu's character. It's almost it's so refreshing, but at the same time it's very experimental because we never really seen, how do I put it, I think
gay daughter,
yeah I think so. I mean, there is the Half of Us, what's that movie,
also Saving Face as well, from the 90s,
2000s. But all those gay characters, the female lesbian characters, were still very
unsure about their sexuality.
Joy, the character in this movie, was still there is, you know, uncertainty about her life, but that is incorporated of how her mother is not fully approve of what she is as a person. That's why she is like that.
Yeah, and in the movie, we should say also, obviously, if you've seen it, she's got a girlfriend, and the mother, Michelle Yao, is kind of like hesitant to tell her father.
The granddad, who is played by Jens Hwan.
Yeah, yeah, classic.
So brilliant.
Always, he's always, and you know, Asian guy, they just get him. Always. Her needing to be acknowledged as a lesbian, like for her to acknowledge the granddaughter as someone who's with a girlfriend.
I think what I really liked her character is that because she's an unconventional stereotype Asian woman's look. You know, she's fuller, she's not that conventional skinny, tall.
Yeah, petite,
with fox eyes. She's got a rounder face and she's really voracious about her languages. She doesn't care. Yeah. What other people think, except for you can tell that she's also very reserved. She knows the boundaries. It seems like she knows the boundaries, you know, when the granddad is there, she knows the boundaries. It was just really, really good. And you know, the first scene where we see her face, the moment I saw her face, I'm like, oh my gosh, she looks exactly the same as our cousin.
Yeah,
so similar.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah.
I thought the music was really good as well.
Yes, yeah.
So we should mention that this is the people who made this film, they're called the Daniels.
Two Daniels.
And I had never heard of them.
Yeah, one of I've the Daniels is Daniel Kwan and the other one is Daniel something. Yeah.
And the other the other movie they made was Swiss Army Man, sorry.
Was it the one with Daniel Radcliffe? Yeah, that was unusual.
Have you seen that
movie? I only seen the trailer and it was a very weird movie, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Apparently they're known for their weirdness. But it's a lot of parallels have been drawn by this movie. A great tweet that Helen's been sending around is like this tweet by this guy who said something like Encanto, Turning Red, Everything Everywhere. They're all now movies where like parents apologize to their kids, and it's like, and then he's like, yeah, dream on.
That's never gonna happen.
Yeah, that's never gonna happen. Yeah, exactly.
But this is what I say about, you know, I call it like a collective healing for us. As we know that it will be a struggle for our parents to apologize. But when we watch this kind of movie, we kind of get the sense that our parents is apologizing through these films, you know, and we're kind of overcoming all those generational traumas. And especially that we are seeing from the lens of the previous generation, the hard work they had to go through, leaving home, leaving their own country, going to a very strange environment. And also the part that I really enjoy watching, this is going to sound very strange, but I'm going to really praise how the writers portray the Asian men in this movie.
Wei Men,
the character.
Why do you say it's going to sound strange? Why did you?
Because I never really praised the men. It's always because what we've seen typically in a lot of films is that the men are very masculine, they're very straightforward, the characters we see are so powerful, and just a lot of toxicity that are presented through the movies, you know, what we see in the men. But in this movie, the Asian man that is presented, Hui Hui Kwan, really brought in different versions of Wei Men in the movie. You know, the multiverse, which means that they have to play different versions of themselves. It's almost like acting different roles for multiple movies. Yeah. And I see a lot of gentleness from an Asian man that is really cleverly depicted throughout the movie, and the desire from him that he wants to receive the love that he wants to receive from his wife. I don't know if I'm gonna choke up, but there was quote.
I can't say that line without bursting into tears.
Let me have a look. Sorry, I just have to pull it out because I remember vaguely how the quote that he said in one of the multiverse they didn't end up together.
And she's a famous actor.
Yeah, she became famous. Yeah.
There was one line when she said it was really funny. She was like, "Oh, I saw my life with you and it was great." Remember?
Yeah. So this scene was that where they didn't end up together. She became famous as an actress, as a, you know, like a Hong Kong superstar, movie star in Hong Kong. They encounter each other at the premiere or something, and they talked about what if they end up together. He said, I'm gonna cry now. He said that I would.
I can't say it.
But it just breaks your heart. I'm just gonna take a moment. Okay, so the quote is, I would have loved doing laundry in Texas with you. We are both in a mess.
I know. Why is that so emotional? I don't get it either. Like, that line fucking rips me apart.
It's like you're regretting something, but at the same time, I mean, in that world, in that universe, they were not unhappy. But I think they feel the regret of pursuing the life that they could have together.
I remember telling Andrew, I was like, that line is like, that is like probably the best line ever about true love. Or like just like real love, I guess. Like that's real love, I think.
Yeah. It's not like I will die for you, or I will make thousands of money. It's nothing dramatic. Yeah.
It's just like the doing laundry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. And I am like, I've never been so certain in my life that I will never get married. Like, I just am so not interested in getting, well, like, I'm just so not interested in having a wedding. But if I ever had a, like, in a multiverse, if I had a wedding, that would be the line I would use.
Yeah, just something like, I just think so that simple.
Single line is so, captures everything about, I think, what real love is. There's no fireworks, there's no fireworks, no, like, fucking lust or anything. Like, none of that's real. Like, I think what is so emotional about this quote is that it feels very, for me, it feels like it touches me in a way that, like, it just feels so, so real.
It's just the humanity in it, I think.
Yeah.
It's nothing, you don't have to do anything big to show how much you love someone.
Exactly.
Laundry and text. It's the essential, the essence of your life. Yeah. And you have someone who tells you that, I'm willing to do that with you for the rest of your life or something. Or a period of time. It doesn't matter how long, but just beautiful and romantic for us.
Yeah, exactly. And I love what you said about this character. And, like, I feel like Asian men are the future of this world in the sense that they show us a way. Like, often I say this about, like, gay men. I'm not saying Asian men are more gay. But, like, just, like, men who are who allow themselves without fear to be tender.
Yes.
And I feel like this guy is very, very filled with tenderness.
Definitely,
and I love that. It's so – it's and that quote – I think that's why we feel it so heavily, because it's so tender.
Yeah.
And the fact that the guy said it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the guy said it is so beautiful. Because men are not allowed to be tender and gentle in this world.
Yeah, that's how the society constrains how they say, you know, something like this is a lot of people that misunderstood about how tenderness is vulnerability or it's weak or something like that. But I really love how this movie created the Wayman's character, because there was also a part how he described how he coped with stress. You know.
Yeah. What did he say? Can you remind me?
I think he said that he uses fun and positive ways to cope with the mundane human life. It does not mean that he's not stressed.
Yeah, he said that
it's his strategy and mechanism to cope. You know, compare the usual portrayal of how man responds to crisis through violence, you know, through attacks. But he had this playfulness around
him. Yeah, I loved his playfulness and his optimism.
Yeah, and he's always like saying that, yeah, we'll be fine, we'll be okay.
Yeah, exactly.
He's always there to support Evelyn. And you know how that's the googly eye element in the whole movie. And
I love that, by the way.
I think it has the kind of the significance of how a lot of mythologies, a lot of stories, I don't know in other cultures, but I think in Asian culture, you know, we have the third eye just the middle of
like
the
the
third eye in our forehead. Yeah. It kind of opens up to see other worlds or the parallel universe. So I think there is a part of like a symbolism in there.
I think my favorite, most like the most emotional scene for me, like after I told this to Andrew, after I watched it, the most emotional scene for me was the scene, you know, the alternate reality in the movie where they're both rocks and just the daughter and mother. Uh-huh. I love that, by the way. Yeah. I did think, oh, how would the blind people be able to watch that scene? Because you had to read off the screen.
Oh, yeah.
But I love that scene because I love the first time we encounter that scene, because it's like this whole movie is like absolutely like crazy for like an hour and a half.
Yeah,
and
then suddenly you have
like five minutes of quiet. Yeah. It was so well timed. But I think the most emotional scene for me was when at the end at some point when the whole black hole scene
the bagel
converges and you see they change the scene, they cut to the one rock, the daughter rock falling, and then the mother rock falling after it. Yeah, that for me was very, very emotional, like
I saw stop making this kind of movie for a little while. Otherwise, our therapists are going to be overbooked.
Like I said, it is just it's just basically at the end of the day a beautiful movie about a mother and a daughter and the love between those. Yeah. Seriously, and the moment I finished seeing it, I was just texting Helen and I was like, "You should watch it, obviously, because I just think Helen, you would. I wonder how much more you felt because you're a mother and a daughter.
Yes, like, I'm caught in between.
I'm not a mother yet, but you're like, you know both worlds.
Yeah.
So like, and how hard is that? That like, I wonder how much, how much more you felt because you're also a mother.
Yeah, I think it's like a, there's a turn in Taiwan we call like sandwich generation, where we have our parents still alive and we have kids to look after as well, and we're caught in between
the hardest
how
period,
we can
apparently.
Respond as a child of our parents and also a parent of our child. It's very emotional for me to watch this because I can feel the impact from being a daughter as well as a parent, and how hard it is for individual that kind of position to overcome the struggles. I think it is a very good film. Like I said, you know, I can't emphasize enough, it's like a collective healing for a lot of Asian diasporas out there, and also I think just generally Asians, because a lot of Asians will have similar experience of how it's very hard to communicate to your parents, and you want to overcome those kind of difficulties, but you don't know where to start because you always end up in an argument or a fight and just goes nowhere. I don't know what else to say about. Oh, actually, there's one thing that I want to mention is that the language, the portrayal of the language was done.
Oh, it was great.
So brilliantly. It
was so good.
You know, last episode, we talk shit about how white productions can't do foreign language correctly. Yeah. Thankfully, that in this production, and because it's all Asian crew, and I believe that throughout this production, there's a lot of Asians involved as well.
Yeah.
So they were done very well, and because we all know that all the characters, I hope they do speak fluent Chinese, the Mandarin and Cantonese, where we see that Evelyn and her father conveys in Cantonese. I believe they might, like, the family might be from Hong Kong or somewhere around Guangzhou.
Yeah.
So they spoke Cantonese. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Whereas Evelyn and Wayman, they spoke Mandarin. I'm suspecting that the character Wayman is more of a Vietnamese Chinese immigrant.
Right, right. Because and also the daughter looks Vietnamese.
Yeah, the daughter's a bit more Vietnamese as well. But, you know, it's everyone's have a different judgments on that, but I think there's also the Asian American accent, you know, with a combination of English bits and pieces throughout their dialogues. Yeah. That's what I love. Yeah. It really feels like a safe place, I think. Yeah.
It was so amazing. And like films like this one and then like Turning Red recently, I just think like it's really, I feel so hopeful. I feel so like this, like we talk about this Helen, and then like I just think I compare it to like, I know it's different, but I compare it to like STC's White Pearl, and I'm like, you know, it's just, you can't even compare them, because it's like, I guess the point I'm making is that this is the kind of art I think that is useful and necessary in the world.
Mm.
Not the kind that pushes us into more narrow stereotypes.
That's true.
Nothing about, I feel as though.
And you actually see the backstory of why they become like that. The struggles.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, obstacles.
Yeah, they're humanized.
Yeah, humanized.
Basically.
Yeah, exactly.
They're humanized, yeah.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of art that changes the world. And I can't even begin to imagine how many thousands and millions, hopefully millions of people who watch this with an Asian face and feel seen, you know, have their lives, have their sense of self and the power that they feel that they have in this world enlarged in the way that, like, it's such a normal thing for white people.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I hope. And I think this movie gave me a lot. It gave me a lot of strength.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in one of the interviews that Michelle Yao had, she specific...
I loved watching her interviews.
She specifically said that it is a movie that is presenting a character that has been often been unseen by the overall society.
The immigrant woman, you walk down the street and you see her.
That's right, And an aging immigrant woman who is almost be considered as invisible in the society.
Yeah,
but at the same time, they hold the whole family together. You know, how hard they work for the whole family and also for the communities as well. I think they really show how she worked around the people who, the clientele around her laundromat, how she interacts with them. And how that is a hold up, how that the work is really holding up a community as well.
I just have to say, this is like the thing I should have said at the very, very beginning of our discussion. This is like the first thing that I mentioned to Andrew. Did you watch this by yourself or with someone?
I went to see it with Sean. Yeah, with my husband.
Okay, Oh, did he cry?
I think he's tried to hide his face. I brought a towel with me. I brought a face towel because I know what's going to happen.
I warned Helen. And also, did you wear a mask?
Yeah, I wore a mask.
And that collected all my tears, thank God. But I just have to say, even from the very first shot, do you remember that first shot where like the camera pans into the reflection in a mirror of the three of them singing karaoke?
Yes.
Do you remember that? Yeah. And then in the corner, did you notice in the corner, there was that Chinese cough syrup that we grew up with.
Oh, really?
That was in the corner. Okay. And immediately, I was like, this actual scene. That's all I needed. I didn't need the next 2.5 hours,
that's a
honestly.
Fucking brilliant symbol for all the Chinese out there. You grew up with that cough syrup.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly.
And you don't know they're selling at your Woolies and Coles now.
Oh, my God, really?
I think so. Some Woolies and Coles selling.
Oh, my God. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's I should have said that from the beginning. But yeah, totally, this is what real art does. It makes you feel seen. I think it's simply that.
Yeah.
Makes you feel seen.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant movie. The final 30 minutes, I feel like I was going to suffocate
within
my mask.
With your tears?
Yeah.
I know.
Because
me too.
I don't want to sniffle so loud. I'm like
right
and I had to like pull my mask a bit a gap and then put my towels and wipe my nose.
Was there a packed cinema around you? Like who was in the audience?
Of course, all whites, but I think it's a younger generation. I'll say around 30 to 50 year olds, not a lot of older people, but it wasn't packed because, you know, where I live, I don't feel like this is the kind of movie that will make a lot of people who live around my area want to go and see. But what about you? Do you want to see the movie?
We went to Randwick Ritz.
Okay.
Because I haven't been there since.
But Randwick there's a lot of Asians around that.
Yeah,
area,
it was pretty diverse. It was quite a packed cinema, it like you said at the very beginning of this conversation, it was an experience. It wasn't a movie.
Yeah.
It was a full body, very altering experience for me.
There was one part that the sound was so loud, the whole cinema shocked. I don't know if you ever had that in your session, but it was very loud and there's a lot of flashing special effects. Yeah, I don't know, like the words that we used to describe on this episode, it's not enough to describe this movie.
Yeah.
You just have to go and see it.
I know. Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's it. That's all I have. I think I've said enough. I mean, I don't need to say more because I think... you can hear from the listeners, I think they can hear from all that crying that we've done just by talking about it, you know, like how much emotional impact it had for us.
Yes.
Honestly.
Lot. Yeah.
I think it impacted me much more than turning red.
I think so too.
Much more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so too. I was just wondering whether or not, like I know what the movie's going to be about and because how much it resonated with Turning Red, I did have a moment of thinking whether or not that I should take my 9-year with me. But then I was glad that I didn't, because I know that in the past
it's so
that
violent.
Was quite inappropriate, and I have no idea.
Oh yeah, the sex toys.
I don't know how to explain it to her.
The dildos. Yeah. Yeah, I found actually some parts quite violent.
Yes.
Like Kill Bill violent. And I was like, I don't know how much I can take of this. But it actually didn't get to too bad.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it didn't get to too bad. So
because it uses like several violent scenes to be stylized as a comedy where they blew up the hair and they had confettis flying out.
Yeah, that was really beautiful.
Yeah. So it's almost like, I think it's like a combination of Kill Bill, The Matrix.
And Eternal Sunshine.
Oh, yeah, Eternal Sunshine, that's right.
Those three films,
vibe.
Yeah, that's it.
And a bit of like Farewell.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so that's it from us. Anything else?
Yep, that's it. Okay. I think I have had my emotional burden offloaded today.
Amazing.
I'm going to go and have some lunch now.
Okay, that's the end of our episode. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Google, and Apple. Remember to give us a 5-star rating. If you would like us to support what we do here at Asian Bitches Down Under, head to our Buy Me Coffee page to make a donation for us to continue the intersectionality in the podcast industry. Please follow us on Instagram at asian.bitches.under. Oh, sorry, I have to start that again. At asiansbitches.down.under for updates and share with your fellow podcast lovers. So we'll chat to you next time. Stay safe, everyone.
And don't forget, guys, go see the movie.
Yes, go and see the movie. You know, it's got the highest rating on Rotten Tomato at 96%.
Ever?
Yeah, apparently it's ever.
Yeah, exactly.
So fucking hell, we're doing better than this Asian cast.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
My son says, my kid says that Michelle Yeoh is going to be up for an Oscar next year for this.
For this?
For sure. Yeah, that's what my kid said.
Oh, you know what? I think she deserves it
better than
much
Oscar.
More than that.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, the Oscars is a joke.
That's right.
Yeah, I know people say that. But also, it's like the white gaze.
See, there's
that.
A complexity in it again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay, we'll talk to you next week, guys.
Bye.
Bye.